It's a very important part of this mix that the U.S. somehow returns to fiscal sanity. You know, unfortunately, there's just no appetite to have that discussion.
At this moment of financial instability, can policymakers avoid the mistakes of the past? My guest for the first of CEPR's special podcasts on global imbalances thinks that history can be our guide to correct them. But will politicians be brave enough to do what it takes? Welcome to Vox Talks Economics from the Center for Economic Policy Research. I'm Tim Phillips. The fourth Paris report from CEPR and Bruegel is called The New Global Imbalances. In a high debt and fragmented world, excess savings, rising surpluses, and rising deficits pose a risk to stability and undermine the global trading system. But Maurice Obstfeld of the Peterson Institute for International Economics and CEPR points out, we have been this way before, many times. In his chapter in the report, he explains how previous episodes of global imbalances ended and, spoiler alert, they didn't always end well. When we spoke, I asked him about what history can teach us and whether today's policymakers have learned those lessons. Maury, welcome back. We speak quite regularly now.
It's great to be here with you, Tim.
We're talking about global imbalances in this report. Some people might really not know what imbalances are. What is not balanced?
Global imbalances are divergences between countries' income and their spending. You know, if you spend more than your income as a country, you have to borrow from abroad. If you spend less than your income, you're investing in foreign countries. Very much like what happens to you or I if we overspend or are in a position where we are able to save and accumulate wealth for tomorrow.
I know my bank would rather that my current account was more in balance. Does the global economy require that individual economies everywhere are in balance?
Oh, absolutely not. That's neither normal nor desirable in general. You know, countries that have a spell of bad luck that is temporary may want to borrow abroad to smooth out that shock in the same way that you might run down your assets if you are temporarily out of work. Countries with particularly lucrative investment opportunities, but where domestic saving is not sufficient to fully fund those investment opportunities, may wish to bring in foreign investors. Mm-hmm. And that turns out to benefit both the country and the foreign investors. There are many instances in which you wouldn't want to have a balanced current account. And I should define the current account balance. It's basically your national income minus your total expenditure, which would consist of consumption, investment spending, and what the government spends.
The fact that the current account is not in balance in the United States is something that President Trump often talks about. If we look with a historical perspective, which we're going to be doing today, is it at a historical high?
Well, it would be a mistake to look at the number of dollars that are associated with the current account deficit to make that judgment. A much more sensible way to look at it is to look at the current account balance as a share of gross domestic product, because if the economy is growing over time, exports will grow, imports will grow. So to judge whether you're in an unusual period of a very, very high current account, you would want to look at the ratio to gross domestic product. Mm-hmm. And in fact, by that metric, the current account deficit of the U.S. is not historically high. The historic high occurred around 2006. It was about 6% of gross domestic product. At the moment, it's more like 4%, actually in 2025 was 3.9%. So you're only about two-thirds of the all-time high.
Now, also, his explanation for that 4% is that foreigners are somehow cheating the U.S.
It's an amazing thing, and taking advantage of us, ripped us off and left us for dead, frankly. And I believe if I didn't become your president, I believe that this country would have had problems like they've never had before.
Is this explanation one that's been used before?
Oh, it's very common to blame current account deficits and trade deficits on foreigners who don't provide access for our exports or who cheat by subsidizing their imports. But while it's true that one way to think of the current account balance is as exports minus imports plus net earnings on foreign investments plus any transfer payments from abroad, an equivalent way to think about it is as domestic saving minus domestic investment. And this is the logic I explained earlier. If we don't save enough to cover our investments, we have to borrow that balance from abroad. If we save more than we can profitably invest at home, we're going to lend it to other countries where investments may be potentially more lucrative. From that perspective, if you look at saving minus investment as being equal to the current account balance, a negative current account could mean that you're investing a lot. Now, that's often thought to be a good thing, because if you invest a lot, if your investments are very productive, you're increasing future output. It could also mean that saving is too low, and that is generally not a good thing.
No.
Because you're being improvident, and that may come back to bite you later on if bad times arrive or if your international credit dries up. In the case of the U.S., household savings are quite low. Another really important actor in the economy whose saving is quite low is the federal government. It's running a huge deficit as a percent of GDP. And that goes a long way to explain why the country as a whole has a low rate of saving and why it is therefore borrowing resources from abroad. You know, it's hard to blame our low rate of saving on foreign countries.
One of the fascinating things about your chapter in the Parrish Report is to be able to take a longer historical perspective on these episodes. And we'll look at a couple of those in a moment.
This is one of two podcasts we're publishing today to mark the launch of the Paris Report. In our other episode, Gilles Nowek, chief economist at AXA, explains why the US government is so keen to promote investment in dollar stablecoins and the risks this might pose to the financial system in the US and Europe. And go to Bruegel's podcast, The Sound of Economics, to find an interview with two of the report's editors, Beatriz Vader de Mauro, president of CEPR, and Jeremy Zettelmeyer, director of Bruegel, about the problem of global imbalances.
There was a high deficit in the mid-1980s as well. What was the cause of that?
The mid-1980s were a time of significant macroeconomic turbulence. The deficit really begins rising earlier in the 1980s.
Mm-hmm.
There are a number of factors at work. One is the tight monetary policy that Paul Volcker embarks on in the face of the very high inflation of the 1970s. He decides to once and for all confront that inflation by allowing interest rates to rise to very high levels. And when that happens, the dollar appreciates sharply. And that makes imports cheaper for the US. It makes exports more expensive for foreigners. So that's a contributory factor to the trade deficit. But also important in driving the deficit and also driving the dollar up is the fact that President Reagan both lowers taxes and raises military spending. Those actions balloon the U.S. fiscal deficit, which directly feeds into lower saving. It feeds into somewhat higher interest rates. It feeds into a stronger dollar as well. And so you have this very potent mix of factors that's driving the dollar higher, and that is driving interest rates high, and that is driving the current account into what was at that time an unprecedented deficit relative to U.S. GDP.
And this leads to the Plaza Accord in 1985. What was the Plaza Accord?
Well, the Reagan administration had initially been following a policy of benign neglect to the dollar, basically taking the very Milton Friedman-esque view that the markets are always right and we should just treat this with laissez-faire, or as it was described at the time, benign neglect. And the problem with that is it's politically not really sustainable because exchange rate movements, and particularly big exchange rate movements, can have distribution effects in the economy that may help some. So, you know, consumers with access to cheap imports are happy about that. Mm-hmm. But if you're in an export industry and your industry can't export abroad and workers are being laid off, then you're not so happy. Particularly in industrial heartland states, which were important exporters, pressures arose, and these were very quickly transmitted to the legislators in the Congress for protection, for high tariffs, quantitative restrictions on imports that might offset some of the effects of these exchange rate changes. And we can ask whether those measures might have been effective or not. Economic theory tells us that they may not have been very effective, but nonetheless, when such competitive pressures arise, there are always calls for protection. Mm-hmm. This alarmed the Reagan administration. It alarmed our allies in Europe. After Reagan's re-election in 1984, his new Treasury Secretary, James Baker, perceived that benign neglect was not working so well. He proposed, with four of our largest allies, that there be a joint announcement that these major countries felt that the dollar was too strong, that it needed to depreciate further. It has actually already started to depreciate somewhat, and that they would stand ready to counter disorderly conditions in the foreign exchange markets, quote unquote. So that was the Plaza Accord, and the exchange rate did continue falling to levels that eventually were so low that another accord took place, the Louvre Accord, to stop it. What was interesting about the Plaza Accord was that everyone agreed that the exchange rate was in the wrong place. And that's what helped make the intervention effective. Mm-hmm. You know, and then it was not only a verbal intervention, there was actually sales of dollars in the foreign exchange market and purchases of foreign currencies by the participating countries. But there was actually less agreement on the diagnosis of why the global imbalances had gotten so big.
Yeah.
The Europeans felt it was the U.S. deficit. The U.S. felt that Europeans weren't doing enough to stimulate their economies, which if they had stimulated their economies more, they might buy more from the United States. So here you can see these two perspectives on the current account. You guys are saving too little. Europeans were saying to the U.S. and the Japanese were saying to the U.S. The U.S. was saying, you guys aren't importing enough. Events overtook these discussions and led to a resolution of the global imbalances. But these were not really the events that people would have forecast in 1985.
While the Plaza Accord successfully moved the exchange rate, it wasn't the policy to fix the deficit problem.
Yeah, I mean, the U.S. government did enact further fiscal legislation that to some degree helped by closing some loopholes and the like, but there wasn't really an agreement on policy coordination beyond the agreement that we don't like where the currency is and we should intervene. And that's kind of an easy way out because, you know, it doesn't really require any hard political decisions. The central bank or the treasuries can intervene at their discretion. They don't have to go to a legislature to raise taxes or lower spending. So it's sort of an easy way out, but it doesn't really address the fundamental drivers of these imbalances. If you look at the data from the time, you basically had the U.S. on one side with a big deficit, and Japan and Germany on the other side with big surpluses. And what really definitively erased the German surplus was not a post-Plaza German agreement that they should expand their budget. It was actually German reunification. Germany facing this historic challenge of absorbing East Germany, of improving its infrastructure, of helping it transition to the market, decided that they could run significant fiscal deficits, and their current account swung into deficit. And that's really where the resolution, as far as Germany was concerned, occurred. You know, in the case of Japan, the Japanese bubble economy emerged with all the spending and investment that that entailed. The saving investment imbalance for Japan was resolved in that way. But that wasn't, you know, really a conscious policy. And it did end in tears.
So fast forward a couple of decades from the Plaza Accord, and we're in the mid-2000s. And as you say, this was a time when the deficit was at its historical high. The common explanation for this, the conventional wisdom, was something that you've already mentioned again, a global savings glut. Was this true?
Well, the theory of the global savings glut is that if savings rise outside of the US, that will depress global interest rates, that will raise asset prices in the US because the US is the most attractive destination for these savings. And both the lower interest rates and the higher US asset prices will encourage US spending, which gives rise to a bigger US deficit. So that's a very neat theory. And one implication of that theory that I think is very important is that as all these savings flow into US assets, the dollar should get stronger. I mean, that stands to reason. So why might global saving have risen in the late 1990s, you know, very early 2000s? There was a significant financial crisis, not just in one Asian country, but it burned through a number of Asian countries, you know, Korea, Thailand, Malaysia, Indonesia, big significant countries. These countries had to go to the IMF for support. The experience was humiliating for them. They decided that we don't really want to have to go through this again. They began to accumulate dollar reserves as precautionary balances to put them in a more resilient position. To this day, these countries hold substantial dollar reserves. There were also bigger surpluses from the oil exporters, which added to global saving. So, you know, if you look at the late 90s, early 2000s, there's a lot to be said for this story. Because it's not a perfect fit to all the data, but it's plausible. Starting around 2002, the story becomes less plausible. Global saving really isn't growing anymore, but the U.S. current account deficit is expanding. And furthermore, the dollar is depreciating. It's beginning to plummet like a stone. What's going on? Well, a couple of things. First of all, in the early 2000s, there's a recession in the U.S., partly associated with the World Trade Center attack. And the Fed is actually worried about becoming like Japan, which has for a decade been living in its post-bubble state of deflation pressures and very, very low interest rates. The Fed keeps interest rates low, promises they'll be low for long, and adopts a very loose monetary policy, one that's significantly looser than what you're seeing abroad in comparable industrial countries. So this is one factor behind both the U.S. deficit and the weaker dollar. The other big factor is the housing boom in the U.S., related to the low interest rates that the Fed is creating. It's also related to innovations in the financial markets, in the mortgage markets, subprime lending, the growth of certain forms of securitization. And this is driving up housing wealth. It's leading people to spend more. They're extracting equity out of their appreciated homes, taking out second mortgages to extract that equity. That's borrowing. That's spending. That's all pushing the U.S. current account more negative. And as people borrow more, they're issuing dollar bonds. And this issuance of dollar bonds is pushing the dollar exchange rate down. So I would argue that from roughly 2002 until the eve of the financial crisis, what we're seeing is not the capital pushing into the U.S., but capital being pulled into the U.S. by higher U.S. spending, more U.S. borrowing. And we tend to forget the state of the world in 2008. Think about 2008, we think about the Lehman crisis in the fall of that year. But if you go back earlier in the year, there was a incredible surge in, for example, oil prices around the world. People were talking about a significant inflation surge throughout the world because, you know, liquidity conditions were so loose. And that's part and parcel of this U.S. housing boom, which was also experienced to different degrees in many other countries. The 2000s generally were a period of very, very loose global liquidity. But I would argue that partly driving it, because it's such a significant central bank and because it issues the world's global currency, the dollar, was this very loose monetary policy by the Fed.
For anyone who was lucky enough to have missed the events of that time, what corrected those imbalances?
Well, it was the global financial crisis, essentially. Spending temporarily collapsed in the United States, private spending. Mm-hmm. Even though there was a fiscal response, you had a major recession. And in demand-driven recessions, the current account tends to improve. If the U.S. is running a big deficit, then on the other side, there have to be big surpluses. China had a surplus. Japan had a surplus. Oil exporters had surpluses. These all shrank. I mean, China did act to stimulate its economy. So did Japan. Oil prices fell globally, which reduced the oil exporter surpluses. The U.S. spending was compressed by the recessionary forces, the collapse of housing prices, and all the things that had pushed the U.S. deficit up so high up until 2006 went into reverse.
So, Maury, let's come right up to date now. This time around, the policy cure for the deficit is going to be tariffs. Will this work?
Tariffs will not have a big effect on the U.S. deficit. There are some aspects of tariffs that push in the right direction, mainly the fact that if you are levying tariffs and collecting some $200 billion a year from U.S. importers, that's a tax increase. Tax increases, other things equal, lower the government budget deficit. That raises national saving. That helps the current account. But we're also simultaneously having in the U.S. tax legislation, the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, which pushes in the opposite direction by lowering taxes, particularly on the rich, or be more accurate to say, preventing tax increases that had been written into the law, but that were now not allowed to happen. It's very questionable whether you're going to see much improvement in the current account. Now, for all of 2025, the current account deficit, notwithstanding the tariffs, was 3.9% of GDP for the U.S. In 2024, it was 4% of GDP. It's quite hard to interpret the trade data for 2025 because there was a lot of anticipatory purchasing of imports early in the year. And in fact, to be fair, late in 2024, after the outcome of the presidential election was known, if you stock up on imports early in the year, then you need to import less later in the year. To some degree, there's a delayed adjustment to the tariffs, which we haven't, you know, fully seen yet. But my prediction would be that if you look at the overall macro package, it's hard to believe that we're going to see a significant improvement in the U.S. current account. Now in the U.S., we're into tax refund season. Mm-hmm. Those refunds are running quite high because a lot of people had calculated their withholding from their paychecks on the assumption that taxes were going to go up. Now then taxes don't go up. So now they're getting refunds. They're going to spend those refunds. We're probably going to see a deterioration of the current account going forward as people spend all that money. The more you spend, the more you import, the bigger is going to be your current account deficit. But, you know, it's so hard to tell the effect of tariffs because so much else is going on. Some tariffs get struck down by the Supreme Court. New tariffs come in. There are a lot of exemptions from the tariffs, some of which are driven by whether you're in or out of favor with the administration. We get a major war with a major effect on energy prices. That's going to depress consumption, at least for people of more modest means. The mix of shocks hitting the economy are quite diverse and quite unprecedented.
policy, as you have been telling us, to correct these imbalances is never easy. What might be good policy, either in the US or in China or in Europe, because we are in an era where these global imbalances are large. In the US, first of all, if it's not tariffs, what would it be?
It is getting the budget deficit of the federal government under control, not necessarily by tariffs, but by sensible cuts in spending. And by that, I don't mean willy-nilly Doge.
Not Doge Mark II, yes.
Right, which really didn't do anything except cripple the federal government with consequences that will become clearer down the road. Sensible spending reduction and efficiencies on the spending side, sensible tax increases, attention to the long-term plight of the big entitlement programs, Medicare and Social Security, which are both in trouble because of our demographic situation. The Congress is just not addressing those at all, and the president is not addressing those at all. We talked about the Reagan deficits, and at the time there were those who felt they were quite irresponsible. Marty Feldstein, who was at the CEA chair at the time, was having a feud with the Treasury Secretary. Even though he was Reagan's CEA chair, he was criticizing the deficits. You know, at one point at a hearing in front of Congress, the Treasury Secretary held up the economic report of the president and said, "This belongs in the trash," and he threw it into a trash bin. It was quite amazing. But for all that, Reagan realized that the Social Security system was on the road to insolvency. And he set up a commission under the chairmanship of Alan Greenspan before he became Fed chair. And reforms were recommended and implemented that put the Social Security system on a firm footing for decades after. But the demographics have become worse. The U.S. really needs to act on that. Now, there's also China and Europe.
Yes.
China has inadequate consumption. This is an assertion that is contested, but if you look at the economy, it's experiencing deflationary pressure. And that tells you that there should be more spending in the economy, probably by the private sector and probably on services, because the service sector is really undeveloped there. Mm-hmm. So the Chinese government, in the latest five-year plan, pledges to address all this. They've done so before. It never seems to happen. And it's really unclear why. There's just not a lot of appetite of the leadership to focus on the service sector of the economy, to enhance social safety nets further in a way that might spur consumption. Part of it is a belief that the future of the country is in high-tech manufacturing, and therefore you want to devote resources to that and to get people to be satisfied with the limited supply of services, of non-traded goods that allows. You have to allow consumption to be low. And it's low primarily at the moment because of the real estate crisis that has unfolded over the last few years. Mm-hmm. You know, housing was the largest component of wealth. Numerous people owned multiple properties. Now they're really hurting and they're not spending. So there's a lot of room to address that, to clean up balance sheets and create a healthier environment, but there's no appetite to really act decisively on that score. And so the current account surplus of China is big and continues to grow. Mm-hmm. In Europe, the problem is inadequate investment, including government investment, investment in infrastructure. The state of German infrastructure is notorious as a result of the Schwarze Null, which now has thankfully been relaxed. The investment climate in Europe is not vibrant. The entrepreneurial climate, the innovation climate, they're not vibrant. You know, the Draghi report, the Letta report pointed this out, made recommendations. Going further in that direction would help, but also going further in the direction of building the defense capability that Europe now needs in light of the growing Russian threat and the growing insanity of U.S. foreign policy. That's an area where Europe needs to come together and where greater defense spending would improve the current account it would lead to a smaller surplus. And the thing that is striking about all of these is that, broadly speaking, they would benefit all three countries, all three, I'm calling the EU a country, but you know, all three actors would benefit. Why don't they happen? Well, you know, as always, there's politics. No policy, even if it's beneficial for the country in the aggregate, is without distributional effects. In the EU case, you have a number of sovereign actors where not only are there differences within them, but also big differences between them. We're really looking at political obstacles, but ideally, there could be a deal that benefits all three countries.
If all three actors don't take that politically unpalatable course, which you recommend, can we continue to kick the can down the road? What might be the consequence if we do?
I think the consequence is going to be more protection throughout the world, not just the US. We look at China in particular, given the trade tensions with the US and the remarkable diversion of China-US trade to other countries, the trade problems that afflicted the US-China relationship are basically being diverted onto other countries. Mm-hmm. And they are facing import surges now of goods from China, which are putting pressure on their industries. It's hard to see how this is sustainable over the long term. Just the structural changes these are inflicting on countries that import from China are politically destabilizing. As far as the US is concerned, its fiscal situation may eventually lead to greater difficulty in financing the government's deficit. We do see worrisome episodes in the treasury market, which, you know, while isolated so far, could get more serious. I worry about the scenario where you do see progress in Europe, because I think Europe is going to move ahead on defense and it's going to move ahead trying to implement the Draghi-like recommendations in its own interest. You know, maybe China will make good on its five-year plan promises. So, you know, imagine those things happen. Both of those actions will tend to raise global interest rates. And we see not only the US government highly indebted, but governments around the world post-COVID are highly indebted. And the private sector is highly indebted. Hmm. And if we get into an environment of sharply higher interest rates, that could be a recipe for financial instability. So it's a very important part of this mix that the US somehow returns to fiscal sanity and takes a longer-term view of its fiscal outlook and overcomes the political obstacles. You know, unfortunately, there's just no appetite to have that discussion. And the public seems unaware that US government is borrowing its way into some real possible problems down the road.
Well, let's hope those possible problems don't materialize in ways that we have seen in the past. Murray, it's always great to talk to you. Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure, Tim. Take care.
We have been talking about Paris Report number 4, titled The New Global Imbalances. It was edited by Helene Ray, Beatrice Veda Di Mauro, and Jeremy Zettelmeyer. The report is a free download at cepr.org.
Vox Talks Economics is a Talk Normal production. The assistant producer is Megan Bieber, and our editor is Andrei Zagarian.